This podcast is from heptagonclub.co.uk and paulcarenza.com. The Heptagon Club.
Heptagon Club.
Heptagon Club with Paul Carenza. Seven guests, seven corners.
On this week's show.
I did a thing with Roger Moore once.
So that was Jeremy Corbyn. Jeremy Corbyn, of course, famous for having a beard.
Like UKIP's catchphrases. And then tries to reel off a recipe for a goat masaman curry.
And your host.
Mr. Paul Carenza.
Hello there, friends, regulars and irregulars. You are most welcome to the Heptagon Club, our seven-sided venue of chat and banter. Oh, I miss banter. Don't you miss banter? When it used to be a rare word, used to mean fun, no pressure, entertaining chat. I even did a podcast called Movie Banter, simpler times. Now, of course, it means bants. Well, there's some top bants, if that's what you're after. Right here, we have it in spades. Our rule is simply seven guests per week chatting whatever their field of interest is. Largely that is from the worlds of comedy and media, but who can say? Well, we can, because we know who's on this week. This week it is mostly comedy heavy, it turns out, but what fine exponents of the art we have. Headlining this week, except he's on first, so, you know, opening. But it's Joe Lycett, who is a guy who's everywhere on telly just now, isn't he? He's actually, as this podcast goes up, he's hosting Sunday Brunch this very weekend. He's on the current series of Taskmaster on Dave. An 8 out of 10 Cats Does Countdown went absolutely viral. And he's a lovely guy. So who else this week? We've got the ever-cerebral Robin Ince. We've got Daphne Barham returning, as does character comic Alexis Dubas. On his relationship with his own character, Marcel, drifting into comedy writer territory as well. We have two sitcom writers who I believe have never met. So there you go. That's Tim Reed, who co-created Peter Kay's Car Share, the record-breaking iPlayer-busting sitcom, and Mr. James Carey, who has worked on My Hero, My Family, Miranda, but anything with My in it, basically. And we've got a fascinating insight into the world of adoption and fostering with author and speaker Chris Kandaya, and it really is a truly remarkable insight. All of that is to come. First then, Joe Lycett. Well, I saw him last, I think, on Comic Relief, running a pizza restaurant with Mickey Flanagan. But I first met Joe at Edinburgh Festival many years ago. Before he even started gigging, he saw my old show, Borderline Racist. It wasn't a racist show, it was very complicated, but that was a show I did back in about 2007, I think. And then Joe started comedy soon after. Off he trotted. And whoosh, that is the sound of Joe Lycett overtaking every comedian working today. His show titles are brilliant. That's the Way, Aha, Aha, Joe Lycett. What a title. Some Lycett Hot as well, that's another one. And maybe we will find out this year's.
Joe Lycett, thank you for joining us on this podcast.
Hello.
How are you? How's your comedy world right now?
I'm good. The comedy world for me currently is a lot of writing. I'm writing my next show at the minute. And as ever, I spend more time thinking about the poster than the actual show itself.
Right.
So the actual writing of the jokes is taking a backseat to
excellent
the concepts of what it could be.
Do you have a show title at this stage? Because your show titles are, it's fair to say, legendary.
Yeah, that's very nice of you to say. I'm not sure whether legendary is quite they produce a mild form of amusement in some people.
Well, I was saying to Tim Vine recently, he was after a show title.
Oh, my God, here's a great.
And I suggested to him, that's the way, aha, aha, Tim Vine.
And
he didn't quite go for it, unfortunately. It's
that's
so good, why brilliant. Not keep using it, you know? But
his Tim for you was so good.
Yes, like
that. And the post was brilliant on that, exactly.
Yeah.
It's either going to be... do you really Lycett? Is it wicked?
Excellent.
Or I think I might go with just drop it, Lycett's hot.
Nice, excellent. That's good.
And I've got like a bit of an idea for the poster because I've started doing sculpture.
Right, oh really?
Like doing little clay heads. It's a really weird little side project.
That's nice, that's niche.
It is niche. Yeah. I don't know, I just saw a sculpture about 6 months ago, probably a bit longer now, and I was looking at it, I was going, that'd be fun to do something like that. Yeah. And then I sat down and had a go at it, and it's really hard to make a bit of clay look like a human.
I can imagine.
Really hard.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm going to lessons now. One of the ideas of the poster is to be holding a clay head of myself that I've made.
Excellent.
In the...
sort of Lionel Richie style.
Once that gets passed by my agent, it'll be very much watered down to a shadow of its former self.
How many shows have you done now? This must be your
fourth.
Very good.
How do you find it? I mean, you've done how many shows now?
Too many to think about. I've done about 6 or 7. I think I've done 7.
Does it get easier?
Well, I've always done it around a framework of some sort. Mm. So I've always picked a thing and then just gone, right, let's write lots of things about this.
Yeah.
So when I did a show about taking a different musical genre each
month, first show I ever saw of stand-up full-hour shows.
And then, yeah, well, there you go. That made you think, that looks easy, let's do that.
I see. Steve Day. I saw Steve Day.
Yeah, okay.
I think it was a full hour.
Yes.
But I can't remember what
he said. Well, that one I did was because it was a one-month... a musical genre per month that I listened to solidly for that month. And so that's 12 genres,
yeah.
So pop, rock, jazz and so on. An hour is, you know, 5/12, isn't it? 5/12.
Yeah.
So just 5 minutes on each thing. So I thought, right, 5 minutes of jokes on pop music,
yeah.
5 minutes on classical, that's an hour. And then...
That's
the theory,
yeah.
You know. But then it just gives you something to base it off, I suppose.
That's a much better way of looking at it rather than me just looking at a piece of paper every morning going... Right, let's write something profound and funny.
Yeah, but then you paint yourself into a corner,
yeah,
I find,
really
otherwise
it's
tricky. But, well, no, I mean, with my own one, you know, I was there going, right, now I've got to find another 5 minutes of jokes on ballet or something that I'd sort of suddenly go, right, okay. So
then,
it's been tricky.
Whatever approach you take, I think, like, you are in a corner of your own making, even if it's...
To make yourself do it.
To make yourself do it, or, you know, be abstract and just write about whatever comes to you that day.
Yes.
You know, Tom Stade always had an idea of... process, which was the morning pages, which I don't think was his invention, but he sort of promoted it to me and a few others, where you write just kind of gunk that comes in out of your head in the morning.
Right.
And it's a way of sort of just getting rid of your sort of lazy thoughts. But then I would do like a bit of gunk writing and then go, that's the day's work.
Right.
Done.
And then clock
so
off.
It didn't
actually
work.
I find I end up with a bunch of ideas as soon as I awake. Like, I dream a few good ideas.
Yeah.
I think my best work when I'm asleep, probably. And I wake up and that ruins everything, you know.
I agree, and that's why I nap more than
it's easy, best to do that.
Yeah.
Morning gunk write and then have a nap.
Yeah.
See where that goes. Yeah.
And
that'll be good.
Time for the gig,
and then you're off.
A few beers, and then you've
yeah, exactly, off. Exactly. So is it since your last show? Then, so you've been. I mean, I see you all the time now on the telly box, running pizza restaurants for charity, and on Countdown doing things, and writing letters to different corporations and the like.
Yeah,
and it's been fantastic to see all that stuff come about. So good on you. Well done, you.
Thanks.
Has it been fun? Does it still feel like work, or is it?
It always is a mixture of feeling like work because of the kind of pressure of it. I went into the pizza restaurant thing we did at Comet Relief. I woke up that morning and I was really worried about, like, I'd just wake up that day feeling tired and not like I couldn't do it, because it was live telly. I'd never really done that before.
Right.
And fortunately, I woke up with this sort of attitude of like, well, what's the absolute worst that could happen? None of that's death. You'll be fine, and sort of went in just wanting to definitely enjoy it, and for that reason I sort of did. It was still manic, and I still came away totally exhausted, but I'm endeavouring to approach things with that attitude rather than. I think when you first start doing television, it feels so important to get it right all the time. And you lose some of that, like, youthful kind of, oh, just messing about, doesn't matter, kind of not taking this seriously.
The gleeful anarchy.
Yeah.
Well, things like the pizza restaurant thing, was the anarchy was what made, you know... It was
fantastic.
I mean, I don't know how you even rehearse for something like that, because you've got a full restaurant of pizza customers. That's you and Mickey Flanagan just serving them was...
Yeah. I did try to write jokes for it, and actually trying to hold them in your head and deliver them well to, I think they said it's about 8-9 million people watching. It's like, it's not even worth thinking about.
Yeah.
Like, it's not something I'm very capable of at the minute. So I just thought, actually, what's worked for me in comedy rooms thus far is just sort of my instinct and the first thing that comes to my head, as long as it doesn't have a swear word in it or anything.
Yes.
But, like, it's weird because, like, with telly, like, when you do it, we did one rehearsal and at one point they said, oh, you can't say Pizza Express. And I was like, we're in Pizza Express. You've put us in Pizza Express. And they're like, yeah, it's like a legal thing. It's like,
the logo's everywhere.
The logo's everywhere. We're in Pizza Express, very clear. So I sort of just, you know, I'll just do it anyway.
And I'm pretty sure there were... Am I right in thinking you deliberately referred several times to other pizza establishments as well.
Pizza
there's a bit
Hut,
of Dominoes.
Yeah, yeah, loads of that.
We got delivery or something like that. I don't know.
We got delivery.
Yeah, that was nice.
Yeah. Again, they told us not to do that.
Of course. But, and then you go the other way.
Yeah.
Yes.
What, I mean, once it's done, what are they going to do?
Exactly.
Like,
exactly.
BBC going to sue me?
Yeah.
What's going to happen?
No, exactly. The ship has sailed.
Yeah.
They can't not broadcast it.
Yeah. It's gone out.
Yes, exactly.
So that was a lot of fun. So yes, that was slightly roundabout way of answering that. But yeah, I'm still enjoying it. But it's a very much a case of, I think this is probably the case with life, isn't it? To sort of remind yourself that it's fun.
Yes.
And
yes.
Like, you can take life very seriously, and I've been guilty of that at times. But if you just go, oh, it doesn't matter, does it?
Yeah.
Then actually it's all fine.
It's a business of play, isn't it, really?
So yeah.
You've been doing a bit of that stuff.
You've been dead before you know it.
Well, exactly.
You enjoy it.
More Joe in a bit. Now, it has been quite a week here. I know that many or most of you indeed will listen to this in the far future, so I hope you've had a better week than we've just had. We've had the Manchester Arena attacks were just days ago, and it's heavy on my heart, but I won't pour out here particularly. It's an entertainment podcast, but if you wish to hear my two minutes worth, in fact, I did the Pause for Thought on Friday 26th of May, which was today as I say these words, on the Radio 2 website. That is there. Or indeed, I post that on Facebook as well. But anyway, we carry on. So one other event from this week of recording was the sad passing of Sir Roger Moore, who was very much with us at our live recording. I'll rephrase that. He wasn't with us. I would have featured him earlier if he was on. But no, Robin Ince does mention him in passing. What I mean is that Roger Moore was alive when Robin Ince talked about him, which is what you'll now hear. So this was recorded just one day after the March for Science in London, and that was at our live show. So that explains why you may hear some light chuckles from our audience, and indeed references to those things from Robin Ince.
I did the Science March, which was fantastic.
Oh, yes.
And a very, very beautiful thing, 12,000 people. There is something wonderful about seeing a group of 12,000 scientists trying to come up with a slogan which is both catchy and accurate. Science, good at creating questions, not so good at creating slogans. What do we want? Cats in a superposition. When do we want them? Until observed. But you could see, but we don't really chant, we're free thinkers, and it is problematic. But I got to meet Peter Capaldi.
And he's on the march, was he?
Yeah. And what a really delightful thing as well. He wasn't like, he was wandering around the fine outside the Science Museum, but basically wandering around because people just kept saying, can I get a selfie, can I get a selfie? And he didn't go at the front of the march. There was no kind of, I'm the famous Peter Capaldi, he was there to support the march. But I had this weird thing, which is, I've been fortunate in working with some people who are quite well known, you know, and like, you know, Roger Moore. I did a thing with Roger Moore once, and the only bit I remember is the punchline to a joke he told me just before I went on to the set. And the punchline, I can't remember the setup, he just went, "What's that up my arse, bad bad? You better go on now." And he was a mere 87 at the time. And but when I saw Peter Capaldi, because my son loves Doctor Who so much, I felt as if I was, I thought, I'm going to have to get a selfie with him.
Of course.
And I did, and I still felt embarrassed to do it, and I had to get the organiser. The organiser went, "I'll take you over. Thank you very much. Hello, Peter Capaldi. I'll do a show I'm really fond of. Thank you very much. My son really loves you. I probably love you too, actually. I don't know." And it was a very weird, because the last time I had to ask for an autograph was in 1997, when I had to get Peter Andre's autograph, because my niece really liked Peter Andre. But by the time I got the autograph, she'd gone off it. And it was, so that was a lesson.
Rough, isn't it? It's a rough joke. So was he nice? Was he good when you got the autograph?
I thought he was great. Yeah. I thought he was, and I love the fact that people like Peter Capaldi and I think Matt Smith stuff going, yeah. You know, when people like that go on things like the Women's March and go on the Science March, I think it does have an effect, whether we like it or not. You know, so often we see, you know, the use of celebrity for bad things or dull things or banal things. And the Women's March, which I couldn't go on, my son went on the Women's March with my wife, and he's 9, and about halfway through she went, "Oh, stop being so bored." And he went, "I'm 9. You would have been bored if you'd gone on a march when you were 9. And she's like, "I can't argue with that." You're entirely right. But he came up with some good chants, but the only chant that he did, I loved Fiona Apple's chant. Did anyone know about Fiona Apple's chant for the Women's March? It was beautiful, and they did a kind of remix on it, and it was, "We don't want your tiny hands anywhere near our underpants," which is just really catchy.
Nice. That's the sort of slogan you chant you wouldn't get from the scientists, isn't
it? No, they'd have had to check with some kind of graphs and statistics about the size of the hands? Would they qualify as tiny or merely like mildly anomalous?
I love like popular science, and I love really getting into quantum physics at the minute. This thing that came out yesterday where they said they've created an atom that breaks one of Newton's laws. But like, if it's an atom that is, I can't remember what the atom, what element it is, but they've frozen it to just above absolute zero, and then when you push it away from you, it comes back at you. Rather than going, like Newton's law is, if you push an object away,
right. It
goes away from you.
Okay.
But it basically comes back at you because it's got this unique quantum sort of.
I know, I've had girlfriends like that.
This is the problem, you see. I get really involved in a subject and then I don't think about the funny side of it, and that's why I can't write stand-up.
Well, I was going to say,
do
you do that thing of going, I've got an interest in this thing, right, okay, the next show's on quantum physics or anything like that?
I think, yes, I'll definitely write about that and my love of that, and then, because I'm so interested in it, I don't see the joke.
The next Doctor may have been on the march as well, but we just don't know.
We don't know, yeah.
I was hoping you'd know. I was hoping you'd find out in that autograph.
No, I think the, it's, who would like a female Doctor?
Yeah!
I think it'd be really, I think part of it is it would just be fun to do that, and secondly, it's just really joyous to see dull white men infuriated by things like that. It's just incredible! Max Fury Road! Max isn't in it enough. There's a woman driving.
Oh. I go to the GP. I'm a woman doctor. So they're nice. They listen. Well, the male doctor's been dismissed.
That is true, actually.
It is.
That's the arrogance of... When people wonder why, men... a lot of mortality rate is because men debate. They go, I'm not sure what's more embarrassing and more worrying. Is it more worrying that I believe this lump is some kind of cancer? Or if it turns out it's just some kind of freckle with exuberance, and the doctor goes, it's just a freckle! Why didn't you know that? So I'm not a doctor. It's probably more embarrassing to be shamed by my doctor, so I'll die from this possible tumour.
Well, it's interesting you say that. I've got an appointment tomorrow with my GP to check out this freckle. So
let me have a look. I know scientists.
There you go. So I know.
That's it. Fine.
It's been growing. So I don't know, do freckles still grow? But I'm getting fatter, so maybe that's it. My skin is growing bigger. So they're just getting fatter.
The Heptagon Club.
Seven guests, seven corners. The Heptagon Club with Paul Carenza.
Well, in a moment we will poke under the bonnet with co-creator of CarShare, that Peter Kay vehicle. Oh yes, I did just do two car-based puns in as many seconds there. That, they teach you those skills, writing for Top Gear. As a writer, I'm always interested in the mechanisms behind comedy writing. So we're going to get a bit geeky about comedy writing in a moment with sitcom writers Tim Reed and James Carey. So I hope that you are enjoying that as well. And if you don't, just, bear with us for a few minutes. And the whole point of this podcast is this variety of a heptagon of voices means that we will have lots of interests and fascinations of other people too. So, for example, I love a bit of science. I also love a bit of religion. I'm one of those rare people who thinks that you can be drawn to both science and religion, and that's okay to talk about these things. So one of the things I want to do on this podcast, we've had a bit of science from Mr. Robin Ince, and I want to shine a bit of a light on some pals of mine, known perhaps in religious circles, which I don't mean religious circles like Stonehenge, well, that's pagan, doesn't matter, but more, about the interesting things they're doing. So this guy called Krish Kandar, he has an amazing charity called Home for Good. Home for Good is all about adoption and fostering, and that's what it's all about, really. So this is the brilliant Krish Kandar.
So my family are a fostering and adopting family. We have seven children, three of them have a biological connection with us, four of them are looked after children, either through adoption or long-term fostering. And we love it. We think it's the best thing we do as a family. It's the toughest thing we do as a family.
That's seven. That is a good number. That is
definitely.
Well, partly, particularly, I'll be honest, on this podcast, seven is the optimum number for everything.
Totally.
But seven, that is a family full, isn't it? That is.
We can't have any more.
That is a house.
We've run out of rooms.
I bet you have.
We're allowed to look after babies because up until two, they're allowed to share a bedroom with us as we have to get up in the night to kind of look after
them
and stuff.
Yeah.
But after that, we're full. We had to buy a minibus to be able to get everybody around.
How do you? Okay, yeah. So let's. I mean, there's so many things to take apart. How do you, on a day-to-day basis, seven? So there's seven plus two, seven plus parents.
Seven plus mum and dad. Yeah, me and my wife.
Wow. So that is nine. Obviously, I'm just showing
You're
off
good
now
at
with the math. Yeah. I've done this before. So yeah, so is that one vehicle? Is that two vehicles? Is it?
It was one vehicle, and then it was complicated. So two vehicles. Most of the time, when we travel all together, we're in a minibus.
And equally, I guess that is a spread of ages. So presumably, they don't all travel together at the same time.
All exactly. Sort of our oldest is 18. Our youngest is 7 months. So it's a big gap.
That's the spread.
And actually, because we've got an 18-year-old, a 17-year-old, and a 15-year-old.
Yeah.
What it means is they all help. You know, the old kids get involved.
Yeah.
Our boys in particular are great with babies. Our eldest birth daughter, she's great with toddlers and just all works well.
That's great. Yeah, because you must need, it's like a conveyor belt of children, you must need a factory staff of, you know, it's great. The ages move along, they can help you out. That is...
Packed lunches are complicated.
I can imagine.
Going on holiday, you're taking an awful lot of pairs of socks when you go away.
Yes.
We love it. We love it.
Well, equally, and you say, like, going on holiday and stuff like that, it is, I mean, we've got two kids, which seems, that seems plenty in my household of two. And already holidays are costly, and, you know, let alone the whole recent thing of taking kids out of school.
Oh, man, sort of don't topical get me started. Craziness.
So, I mean, that must be a sacrifice in itself. You know, affording to take a family of nine anywhere, even down the shops, even McDonald's, that must be a...
We don't fly anywhere, because that would be mad.
That would be crazy.
Minibus
that would take
gets
up the plane.
Europe. Yep. We go to a nice sunny beach in France, and we're all happy.
That's incredible. Good work. Did the family situation come first for you then, and then this, so Home for Good and just that sort of passion?
Yeah, that's right. So we got involved personally, and then we got opened up to a whole world that we didn't really know anything about. Just the situations that kids, that bring kids into care. So 70% of kids in care experience kind of neglect or abuse, you know, just the worst possible start to life, and it's not their fault. And so we found out there was a massive need for more foster parents and for more adopters. And we also found out that lots of people think fostering is for poor people, people that don't have any qualifications, can't get a job, and so they could always become foster carers. We don't think that's right. We think all sorts of people can be great foster carers. It might be you've got kids, haven't got kids, might be single, might be married, you name it, your kids might have left home. All of us could be the kind of people that stepped up and made a difference in kids' lives. And what we found out about adoption was that most people that come forward for adoption really want to adopt a baby, but most kids waiting to be adopted are older. And so that mismatch means loads of people are waiting to adopt and loads of kids are waiting to be adopted. So we thought, can we change this around? Can we not make this about, you know, fostering is a way to earn money and adoption is a way to get the kid that you want? Could we say, no, could this be about the children? Could all of us who are able step up and become the kind of people that these kids need us to be in their lives, whether that's through fostering or adoption?
Yeah, because it's quite a big rethink of, I think, how a lot of people see fostering adoption, like, you know, or in particular adoption, I suppose. We have a house, we have this family, what completes our family?
Yeah.
Let's get the, you know, the kid that fits that mold sort of thing.
Exactly.
Actually, that's not the right way to approach it, by the way.
No, and sometimes people come with quite a shopping list. You know, I want a young one, I want a girl, I want it to look like us, I want no special needs, I want, you know.
Yeah.
And actually, we're saying, well, that's quite a consumeristic approach to children. Children aren't there to complete us. If there are kids in the care system that need help, it's all hands on deck. Let's step up and be what they need us to be. It's a real child-centric view we've got.
Yes, totally. And what are the sort of, I mean, I don't know specific stats and stuff, but is there, in terms of the demand and supply of such things at the minute, is there an ongoing, there is a need for this? You know?
Yeah, a child comes into care every 20 minutes in the UK. It's around 35,000 kids come into care. It's about 100,000 kids altogether in care at any one time. There's a real need for foster carers, particularly those that are able to look after a brother and sister together, sibling groups. Because imagine you've come into care and the only people you know for sure love you in the world might be your brother or sister. And the idea that you'd be separated just seems heartbreaking.
Oh, absolutely.
And for adoption, it's particularly people that would be willing to take on kids that might have additional needs, might be older. And we really need lots of people from black and minority ethnic backgrounds. And your podcast listeners won't know, but I'm brown. So that comes,
oh yeah, we, that, that doesn't come through, does it? On the
well, brownness doesn't come out as I'm just speaking.
Yeah, you're, exactly.
Yeah, we need more people from black and minority ethnic backgrounds.
Okay, great. So how, literally, is it like middle of the night, the phone rings kind of stuff, in terms of the practicalities of such things?
So we're emergency carers and long-term carers, so we kind of do a bit of both. So yeah, we got a call once at midnight. My wife answered the phone.
And I don't know if she was fully awake, because she said yes, whatever they asked her.
Oh, no, really? Yeah, okay.
And then 2:30 in the morning, the doorbell rings, and we look out the window, and there's a police van outside, and two lovely police, female police officers have got out, they've opened the back door of the van, and four kids have turned up.
Wow.
And a range of ages, down from, I think, from about 10 down to about 3. And just from the head coverings and stuff, you could tell they were from a Muslim background. Mm. And so it's 2:30 in the morning, and these kids look like, you know, rabbits caught in the headlights of a car, just shell-shocked. And our job is, you know, what can we do to make them feel welcome? We don't know anything about the circumstance. We know it must be pretty bad, that's why they're there. So we go and get the milk and cookies and hope that will help. And, you know, they don't know what to say. And so randomly I banged my head, you know, not on purpose, just happened, and then they all burst out into fits of giggles, and that was it. For the rest of the week I was known as the one who banged his head,
okay,
and would just giggle away.
Yes,
so that's more into your world. Comedy can really kind of break
It's true, it's an icebreaker,
break down some stuff.
Yeah, I guess. And do you get, is it like language barriers and stuff like that as well?
Oh,
or is it...
yeah so we had these two children who had been discovered by a postman, and they had been left home alone, and I think the oldest was 4 and the other one was 2, and no one could find parents. So, you know, social services get called, they get brought to our house as emergency carers, and we're trying to chat away and find out what's going on, and they haven't got much language, and so we try to get them some lunch, and the little girl's saying dummy. I'm going, okay, right, here's a dummy. And I don't know, I had a guess they might be from Nigeria. We didn't know any details about them. So the dummy I was giving her wasn't making a difference. So I put a Nigerian friend on the phone, and she said, not dummy, endomy, which is a kind of, you know, those noodles you can get that you add water to. What she wanted to eat for lunch.
Right,
so it's like,
right.
Yeah, language barrier can be a bit challenging.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was great. It was good we had Nigerian friends that could kind of help
handy,
us out.
That's handy, isn't it? That's handy. Because I know, like, in the BBC, there's this language department in there. So it's like, we need someone on the phone who speaks Sudanese or something.
Yeah.
And they call this person, the person goes, oh, I don't speak it. Someone, Jeff, do you speak, you know, that's... So you need access to that, basically.
I do. Yeah, all I've got is my local church, so I phone them up, and they've normally got a good selection of people.
Okay, that's good.
Next week, then, in the churchy but look what else they do corner, Steve Chalk, known by many as the Rev on GMTV in the 90s, but he is also the world record holder for raising the most amount of money in one single event after his £2 million London Marathon jog. But it was a heck of a fundraise. So Steve Chalk, next episode on that. He also heads up one of the UK's biggest charities, Oasis. So next episode, chatting with him and some other big business bods as well. I thought, well, let's get a little businessy and entrepreneuring with you here. So our next guest will be coming back next week as well. Tim Reed is the co-creator of Carshare and does a lot of businessy things as well. So here he is, Mr. Tim Reed. Let's talk about Carshare. Mm. So that you were co-creator of this.
Yes.
With your writing partner, is that right?
Yes.
And so how does that come about? You had an idea without Peter attached or something? And then
That's right. Well, we were bouncing around all sorts of ideas. At the time, this was 2010, so it was just post the crash, and we were trying to think of coming up with some really easy, cheap-to-make ideas. You know, there was a thing out at the time called Roger and Val Have Just Got In.
Oh, yes.
Do you remember
Dawn French.
Alfred Molina.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And just before then was a thing called The Smoking Room.
Yes,
which
that
I loved.
Yeah, Robert Webb,
That's right.
Yep.
And those really tightly confined situations can really allow you to just then explore the characters.
Yes.
And the dialogue and the stuff that I find really funny. So we were bouncing things around, and then, you know, we had a few different ideas, but Paul, I think, had come in the one day and said, you know, what about a car share? And we both immediately thought, oh yeah, that hasn't been done, that could be great. You know, you could have two characters, and then we start quickly building up, well, who should be in there, who would be funny? And I'd not long read Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, and there are a few things in there that you kind of just think, oh, the points of conflict. You know, one thing particularly that I remember reading was that, I think I might get the numbers wrong, but it's something like, you know, women tend to have 20,000 words a day that they need to get out, you know, for a happy day, whereas for men it's about 7,000, so about 13,000 less. So we often run out as blokes, run out of words by that tea time.
Right.
You know, if you had that, a kind of a fairly flighty, fun-loving, chatty colleague, female colleague, thrown in with a bloke who just wants to listen to Five Live and the news, doesn't talk in the car. You know, the car's not for chatting. And then, but they're thrown together. What you'd hope they'd grow to realise is actually he could do with being a lot more like her, and she could probably do with being a bit more like him. And that was the start of it, really. And then John and Kayleigh were born, yeah, totally without Peter and Sian in mind. In fact, we'd written them being in their late 20s. The Peter thing actually just came along because Paul, who I wrote it with, was old mates with Peter. In fact, they went to school together and still good friends. So when we'd written the first series, 6 episodes, Paul said, well, I'll show it to Peter and see what he thinks. We thought if he likes it, he might set us up with a meeting or introduce us to actually Cheryl Taylor at the time, who was head of comedy at BBC at the time. We thought that'd be like, you know, if he likes it, he could just introduce us. But yeah, he read it and loved it and said, have you thought of casting it? Because I think I could do the main lead, to which my instant reaction was, you're actually about 10 years too old. Right. And I, like, a millisecond later in my brain, I thought, yes, you'd be perfect.
Change it. Yeah, yeah.
More Tim Reid in just a moment, but let me introduce once again a previous guest, James Carey. His most recent sitcom on telly was Bluestone 4-2 on BBC Three, set in Afghanistan.
So you filmed that in South Africa?
We did,
right?
Yeah, in a wine-producing area of South Africa.
Nice.
It was fantastic.
Oh, I bet that was a good few weeks.
Oh, it was amazing.
Yes. Yeah. That seems to be quite a good way of... I know, like, Darren Lytton, who many made Benidorm, you think, yeah, you've landed on a good thing there.
I know.
You've set your sitcom in the sun.
Yeah.
And that's good, you know. You go over there and make that for a bit.
And we have often thought, what could our next sitcom be? Could it be set in a vineyard in Tuscany, perhaps, or something
Hawaiian
like that?
Hawaiian sitcoms,
yeah,
all that stuff.
Yeah, that stuff doesn't really play quite so well.
Yeah, it's tricky, isn't it? It's tricky. Yeah, yeah. And so, and lots of radio sitcoms for you as well, which mustn't have quite as much glamorous travel.
No, no. The West End of London isn't the drill hall usually, just off Tottenham Court Road.
Yeah.
But no, to be honest, I love radio, and if I could make a living just doing radio, I probably wouldn't even have bothered with television. Mm. I just think I listen to tons of podcasts, I listen to loads of audio, I listen to lots of radio sitcoms. My kids are currently obsessed with Cabin Pressure, and they've all listened to each episode about 15 times. Which is, there are worse shows to be obsessed with. It's a really nice show, which I didn't write, by the way. It's John Finnemore's show. And I've been trying to wean them off John's work onto my work. So I've been trying to make them listen to Milton Jones, which is a show I wrote. I used to write Milton's show with him. Used to, still do. We're going to be doing another series at some point.
Yes, that reinvents itself, doesn't it? Every sort of...
Every now and then, Radio 4 gets sick to death of it and say, could you stop doing this, please? And we come back with a, how about this format? Yes.
A new title,
another case of Milton Jones. The what is it? Thanks a lot, Milton Jones. Is the latest incarnation,
right?
Nice. I think the next series will have to be called "Not You Again, Milton Jones."
Exactly.
Something like that.
Actually, I had a listener question. I did have a listener question.
No.
I did. So yeah, it was this person had heard somewhere that the car show radio segments came in later. Then obviously, given that can give the musical cues and things, do you get the earlier draft? Did that come along in the dialogue and stuff as to where that's all going, or is it just a lot freer? Or
so interesting. No, the radio was always in there,
right?
And our intention always was to kind of have the radio as almost like a third character, but that was really more kind of the breaks in the radio and the links and the banal things that local radio. People say, like, you know, things like, you know, I was talking about one recently, you know, things like saying, so that was Jeremy Corbyn, of course, famous for having a beard, and do you have a, or anyone else you know have a beard? If so, phone in now, and those kind of, you know, links, we all thought that would be quite funny to have in the background, just as an extra layer to discover. But then the real use of the music and the type of music, that was Peter brought that in, really.
Right, yes, because he has a certain favourite genre,
and it really added, of course, added a whole other layer to it. So that was
Well, also, and the visual equivalent of that, I guess, the billboards and adverts and shop signs and stuff that's really nice as well.
Yeah, and again, we'd always thought to have some of that and use. The kind of urban landscape quite a bit, because you're kind of thinking, you know, we're conscious from the very start that although it's lovely to have the confines of it's just two characters in a car, you know, from a writer's point of view, I think that's a real gift, because you just you know, you can have so much fun with character and dialogue. But again, we were always conscious that you need to keep the interest. You need those extra bits and reasons to break out of the car. And so things like the interesting landscapes that you get around, you know, an urban commute. Again, always just thought that that adds a whole visual texture to it. Without getting kind of, you know, poncy about it, but it kind of adds something really nice and interesting. And also, you know, it's great for, you know, encouraging people to watch it again.
Exactly. It's, you know, just good value.
Get the DVD on sale in all good DVD shops.
Of course, yes.
You know, and obviously an iPlayer, I think, for that. It's, you know, in fact, it's just broken the record, isn't it?
It's,
you know,
incredible, isn't it?
10 million.
It's incredible on the how it hit and it just held all the positions.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah. That was mad, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And I wonder, again, how much of that is people going back to re-look at those little things.
Yes.
And the signs, again, started to come in as a thought. But again, I think as we got to shoot it and getting close to that level of actually when Peter, as the director, was thinking about different shots, the opportunity then to make more fun of that, I think, became obvious. So, like with anything, and I've seen this in other projects since, you know, the script is the start, isn't it? Especially the first draft script is the start. Yeah. You've got characters and the storylines, but then as you get towards production and then even post-production, you get the chance to think of lots of other layers to add on top.
Yes, it's your blueprint, and you build on the blueprint.
Yeah,
and all that
exactly.
Sort of stuff. So I heard someone describe a script as an invitation to create rather than actually the creativity itself.
Yeah, that's lovely. Nice. Lovely word putting it. When Paul and I first wrote it, I can remember we were sat in his flat. We thought, well, let's put two kitchen chairs together as if it was the car. Mm. So driver and passenger. And when I think I sat in the driver's side and read John out, and Paul sat in the passenger side and read and was reading Kaylee out. But we were also imagining the different bits in the car that you could have fiddle with at the time, like the glove box and the radio. That might have been where the radio first came from.
Oh,
yes. Kind of starting to think of things that you'd be playing with or meddling.
Yep.
Things Kaylee would do that would wind John up. You know, fiddling with the sun visor and the moving the chair as well. If he was, you know, vaguely OCD-ish, you know, which he didn't turn out to be, but that kind of, you know, this is my car, my space, my territory, my cave. And for those early episodes when they were still kind of, you know, rubbing up against each other more than they did towards the end. You know, all of that fiddling around with stuff in the car. Mm. But we got that through. I don't think you can do that easily if you're just, you know, typing a script. You kind of have to act it out and go through the motions and imagine.
Put it on its feet a bit and go from there, yeah.
So studio audience versus, you know, non-studio audience is a question as old as time and all that sort of thing. So with that in mind, and also the shape of sitcom in 2017 going forward, how do you think, is it in rude health? Is it? It's a weird one at the minute. Every time I think, oh, sitcoms have got a bit of a renaissance for a couple of months and then suddenly it goes quiet again, and you look at TV listings now and go, what's here apart from Dad's Army on a Saturday early evening?
Yes.
I don't know.
Well, that you've said it there. I tweet virtually every single week.
That's probably what I was thinking about.
The TV ratings for BBC Two, Channel 4 and Channel 5. No comedy that BBC Two, Channel 4 or Channel 5 make ever beats Dad's Army.
Wow.
Which always gets between 1.3 and 1.7 million every single week and has done for the last year or two. And I think that's interesting. Mm. I don't know exactly what it is, but there is just something about comedy that's not... The non-mainstream comedy is not getting particularly good audiences. It's getting lots of critical applause and people are liking it and there's a buzz about it, but it's not getting the audiences.
No.
And I think that's... So I think there is a shift in the way BBC Two and Channel 4 have been commissioning comedy and the sort of stuff they want, which in turn has led to not enough people shifting onto BBC One and ITV. The people that were making comedy 20 years ago for BBC Two, like The League of Gentlemen and Steve Coogan, they're still making comedy
they
for
are.
BBC Two.
Yes.
Those guys should have been booted onto BBC One, but they haven't. And now the newbies and the rookies who want to get on, where the best chance of getting on is on BBC One, are pushed blinking into the glaring lights and into the withering onslaught of the machine guns of the critics and the everybody else.
And I'm continually told that there's no room on BBC Two ever. There hasn't been for the last several years, by sounds of it.
I don't think there's been any room since about 1996.
Something like that.
Yeah.
that Channel 4 and E4, I think, last I heard is that the room there is reserved for writer-performer stand-ups, doing the thing at Story of Their Lives kind of thing.
Yeah.
And leaves Channel 5 kind of occasionally doing something if you're lucky.
Low budget.
The Gold Channel doing something a bit retro with Nigel Havers,
yes,
if they can find him.
For three episodes.
For three episodes. And then apart from that, it's Sky, of course.
Yeah.
There's people going, is Netflix a thing? I think they're doing comedy. No one really knows. I know production companies going, who's in charge? Do you know who's in charge of comedy at Netflix? I don't know. Is there a comedy department? No one knows.
Yeah.
And then it's BBC One and ITV, like you say. So, yeah, if you're going to fail massively publicly, I suppose.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But it's a tricky time.
Yeah. No, I don't know. I mean, it's...
Things like Fleabag I know a lot of people who are suddenly tuning into that hadn't watched sitcom for a while. I don't know if that sort of thing helps a certain type of sitcom.
A certain type, because it's not, you know, if you like that, you probably won't like the other stuff.
Mm.
So it's not exactly a gateway into enjoying Still Open All Hours, is it?
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that, yeah, there's a variety of reasons. I've done a very boring and lengthy blog post about it on my blog about why mainstream sitcom is struggling. Mm. I sort of had this idea for this blog, and I wrote 4,500 words. So if you're really interested to know what I think, look on my blog for The Ghost of Sitcom Future.
So your blog is Sitcom Geek?
Sitcomgeek.blogspot.com.
Brilliant.
Now, another previous guest from our live show, this is Alexis Dubas.
You have created a monster, Marcel Lucon.
The UK's leading Fox Frenchman.
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. But I'm led to believe that some people are not aware that you are him.
Oh, hugely. I go up to Edinburgh. I do two shows every year in Edinburgh, so I'll do one as me and I'll do one as Marcel, and I never cross-promote. I used to. The first year, I was up doing a show about the history of swearing, and then I was doing my first Marcel show, and I remember... I was kind of excited about doing this new character, and I said to people afterwards, "Oh, thanks for being a lovely crowd. Thanks for coming to the Saturday crowd in Edinburgh. I said, oh, you've been lovely. If you're interested, I'm doing a character show tonight. Yeah, Marcel Lucon, 10 p.m. And I had such a lovely swearing show that afternoon, and an absolute shocker that night. And it was one of those venues where I could hear people leaving behind a curtain, and I just heard the disdain and disappointment. And then someone actually went, "God, it was like it was a completely different person." I was like, "Yeah, that's what character comedy is." Yeah, there's love one and hated the other. So at that moment, I was like, "Right, these are two very separate things."
When I've seen you, I've gigged with you as myself.
Yeah,
and it is like you're embodying something rather. But I remember I did a gig with you. I think it was in Kent.
Kent,
where
they love Marcel in Kent.
Where someone exactly, but there was a French girl in the audience.
Oh yeah,
who came up to you after your act and spoke to you about, "Oh, where are you from in France?" But she was speaking in French.
Yes.
And you carried on this conversation.
Did I get away with it?
About half an hour.
Right.
And you came up, you walked over to me and said, "I think I'll go away with that." And you did talk English. You believed that you were from the same village as she was in France. I don't know how you...
Oh, that was good, yeah.
The accent, you knew where the shops were. I was very impressed.
Yeah, I've done my research. I claimed Marcel to be from a certain town that I'd never visited. And then I thought I'd better go and visit that and actually do some research, and so I did. So I know now, where I claim Marcel to be from, or will be, is actually where my dad's side of the family is kind of from, that area. I've now been there. I went with Si Thomas, another comedian. We went on a little romantic trip to find Marcel's birthplace, made up character, and we did a bit of research, and
fact-finding
mission. That's it. So I can now chat to people from Roubaix and convince them to there.
So it is the bring a bottle moment. We always have this little section of the show where we just ask you to give something back. It's our weekly opportunity for just saying, please help us out a little bit, give us a little boost or something. So this week's bring a bottle moment, we try and make it different each time. This week I would simply like to ask you, would you join my mailing list? It will cost you no more than a few seconds of your time. You can unsubscribe when you like, and then you get all the latest bits from me once every 6 weeks or so. Book stuff coming up. Got two or three big books coming out very soon, end of the year. Some radio spots. I put stuff in there about the new TV shows I'm up to. So if you would like to be on the mailing list, I would love to have you there. You just need to sign up. The link is on this podcast episode description, or it's on paulcarenza.com, if you prefer. paulcarenza.com, PAULKERENSA. About three lines down, there's a little highlighted thing, join the mailing list. If you would do that, it would be great to have you there for that. And as I said, unsubscribe anytime you like. It would just be little bits of information about what I'm up to. Now let us give something back to the fantastic Mr. Joe Lycett. We are feeling generous.
I was trying to think of some show titles for you.
Oh, amazing.
I haven't got very far, though.
Okay.
I've got Joe Lycett and That's the Way It Is.
Oh, nice.
But I don't think that would... People wouldn't get that without the cadence, probably, so it's rather tricky.
But great walk-on music.
Good walk-on music. Then that would explain... People go, oh, I get it. You know, there'd be a collective sigh as they realise what the poster means. They don't Lycett up 'em.
That's really Dad's nice.
Army. You probably need to know Dad's Army to get that.
I don't know anything.
Maybe not. And then I was thinking, then it's just things like Lycett Minnelli, Lycett Doolittle, stuff like that. But that's a different sort of thing, isn't it?
That's a great poster.
Yeah, that's true.
Liza Minnelli. Speaking of which, I sort of love her.
Did I see something about Nigella? Farage thing, is that right? That's a brilliant name. That's a fantastic...
Nigella Farage, which is an act I did in Machynlleth last year at the Comedy Festival.
Okay, excellent pronunciation.
Thank you. Did it for 10 minutes.
Right.
First five was funny. and basically the act is me... she's northern for no reason.
Right.
She's from, like, Lancaster, and her catchphrase is, "You dozy crow." And she comes out, and I dressed, like, full, like, had makeup and everything done for it.
Wow.
And she comes out, and she sort of does, like UKIP sort of just, like, catchphrases and lots of, like, "Oh, it's disgusting, isn't it?" And then tries to reel off a recipe for a goat massaman curry. And that's it. That's all the act is. It's disgusting. Take the goat and prepare it. Like, that's all the act is.
That's a fine concept.
I mean,
It's all there.
I sort of wondered about maybe supporting myself on tour as one of my characters.
That would be a great idea. Great.
Something cuts the cost down, doesn't it?
It does, doesn't it?
I don't know quite how I'd... I suppose I'd have to go on as Nigella and then derobe in the interval.
Yes, I imagine there would be some preparation involved. And then reveal that it was you all along, which they had no idea about.
Well, supporting yourself on tour. Well, that is exactly what happened with comedian Alexis Dubas.
This was a weird one. It was in Belgium. I was gigging in Brussels in Brussels with a French promoter who just thought it'd be really funny to kind of, because I'd love to book you to open for yourself. The deal is like two acts, get on and do two 45-minute sets with a break in between. And he goes, "Yeah, come and do it, and we'll sell it, and we won't say anything. It will be Alexis Dubas and Marcel Lecon." And I thought, well, okay, I don't sell Marcel as being a character anymore, like I say, mainly because people believe that he's a real person. So I thought, well, okay, well, it would make sense to do Marcel second, because then it would be me coming on, and then people go, "Oh, well, that guy's definitely a character. That's the same guy playing Frenchman." And the guy goes, "No, honestly, let's do it that way, and I swear they won't notice. Put glasses on and a hat, and then we'll do it like that." So I went on and did poetry and did my silly stand-up and one-liners and that sort of thing, and then with a glass and a hat on. Then there was a break, then did my hair differently, took off the hat, put the suit on and the roll neck, went on, was like, you know, and then became myself. That's all it takes. And then he came on afterwards saying, because I was going through it going, "I think I've got away with this. I think people don't know." And he came on afterwards and went, "There we go. That was, you see, like, that was Marcel Lecon. And did you notice anything about this guy?" And he went, "Same person." And people going, some people in the audience go, "What? What are you talking about?" And then I was going, like, they really don't believe it. So I came back on in the Marcel suit with the roll neck and just popped my hat and my glasses on and went, "Yeah, there you go, that was me." Same face, you know. And people were genuinely taken aback by it. Idiots.
Alexis Dumas, ladies and gentlemen.
So, from touring solo shows to someone who is off to the Edinburgh Festival, we're going to have a special Edinburgh episode in a couple of episodes' time, probably sort of late July, just teasing you out some of the people going up to the festival. But here's one right now. We've had her on the show before, preaching the merits of getting a comedy director for your show. This is Israeli comic Daphna Barham.
"You need to be told, but you also don't want to hear for a while, which I think is also justifiable, because... You need to do a little bit of the journey on your own, I think. I think you need to do 300, 500 gigs. Is that what you do? Just go there and do it. And you know, the advice that they're giving you is all the time, gig, 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 and you're like, no, but I want to do clowning and see how it works with my..." And they're like, "Well, I'll do clowning if you want, but what you really need to do is be out there gigging." But at some point, somebody needs to pull you back and say, okay, just stop that. Like, you gig them 6 times a week because you're too lazy to write a joke, or because you don't know how to write a joke, which I think was my case. I was not big on writing jokes. I'm entertaining. And I have a big persona and stage presence and whatever. But the craft, I had no idea. I thought, I'm a writer, I write articles, yeah. Right? I've written a book, right? I mean, how hard could that be? And the whole idea of a joke, that is a bit like writing an equation,
anyway.
It is, yeah. I couldn't be honest with it. I think women get angry when I say that, and maybe they're probably right. But I think for many of us, we don't think that way. Men don't have a problem with the idea that they need to learn to do this thing. And this is why you see them when they're new comedians on Twitter and on Facebook playing with these one-liners. Not many women do that. The ones who do that, I'm a massive fan of. You know, women who do one-liners like Beck Hill and Saskia Preston. Yep. And there are a few of them. But I think there's an element of storytelling that we think you just tell it in an entertaining way, it's going to be all right. Which is all right to an extent, but you need to know how to write.
Yeah, it's true. I've not thought you'd get Stuart Francis and Milton Jones and Jimmy Carr and Tim Vine and Emo Phillips and
it's not
Topo, but there's no women in that, are there?
It's not many.
What's your new show? You're
Chicken
doing...
Soup Crusader.
Chicken Soup Crusader.
Yeah, Chicken Soup Crusader is quite a bit of stuff about Israel, but also quite a bit of stuff about the UK, about current events. I've got a big Brexit rant, as you can imagine.
Well, there's a lot to talk about, isn't there?
And Trump stuff. And,
you need it.
Which is hot, because I think what makes comedy interesting is political comedy particularly, is if you speak from your own perspective, not just from your opinion, but also from your personal perspective. Who are you in that story? What is, because we're all affected and implicated by what's happening, and it defines who I am. Like, I'm a product of the politics in which I've grown, both the stuff that was inflicted on me by reality, but also the stuff that was instilled in me by my upbringing and by my personality. So this is what it is.
Oh, great.
I'm trying to save the world with a big pot of chicken soup.
Well, may it work. Yeah,
it might work. I mean, nothing else did. So
I like the fact your fly had a recipe for chicken soup on it as well.
Yes, this is what we decided to. Yeah, because it's a
useful.
It's
flies.
A very sought after recipe. It's a great soup, by the way. Make it. In the last year, I've posted it on popular request on Facebook about 5 times, and I was like, okay, I'm going to make them a flyer. And I'm thinking what to do with it. I might ask people to, because every nation has a chicken soup. Here in Israel, because Jews who keep kosher cannot have meat with dairy, so they have a concept called palve. And these are things that are non-dairy, not meaty. So, like, you can have chicken soup powder, or like it doesn't have any meat in it, so vegetarians can use it.
Right.
So, basically, chicken soup, what I'm saying, is the most universalist dish in the
world. Clearly, maybe that's the solution.
It's the biggest comfort food ever, and we all need some comfort now.
So, comedic comfort food. You can find more online, I assume.
Sort
of web portal.
www.missdcouk. Miss is an unmarried woman, D is in. Me and the letter of comedy. Follow me on Twitter at Miss D Comedy. Misty Comedy, that's my Twitter. Follow me on Twitter, that makes me so happy.
There we go.
And I don't nag too much on there, so that's a good thing. Or Tafnabaram Comedian on Facebook.
Awesome.
And I'm going to be in Brighton, and I'm going to be at the Curious Art Festival in July in Hampshire. And I'm doing Camden, a few days in Camden, the Camden Fringe, which is in August. So I'm doing Camden Hand. And I'm going to be doing probably dates here at the Museum of Comedy, the Leicester Square Theatre. And I'm also looking, this is a few, I'm looking for venues around the UK to go and do the show. I might also go back to Barcelona, or to Paris.
Like to do some gigs in Paris. This sounds good.
Unfortunately, no Paris for me coming up. But I too, like Daphne, I'm doing very similar venues and festivals. Camden Fringe in August. My new show, Navel-less Gazing, is off to Camden at the very end of August, in the August bank holiday weekend. I've got the Museum of Comedy in September with Rob Thomas. That's going to be a lovely show, September 23rd. Also, Kettering Festival in June. Guildford Fringe and the Hazelmere Festival, both in July. I'm doing Liverpool Festival up in the northwest in September. I don't know why I said up in the northwest. You know where Liverpool is. It's the bit by the sea where the Beatles are from. Anyway, September, I'm going up there for that. More on paulcarenza.com or on the Facebook or on the Twitter. Or indeed, of course, you will have joined the mailing list by now, I would hope. Do join up to that and I will tell you more info when it comes around. So yeah, like I say, next episode, I think we will have a business special here from, you know, some little tips from the leading entrepreneurs of today. We'll be hearing about how you go from nothing to running schools, hostels and hostels. Yes, hostel isn't different from hospital, isn't it? Also, how to start a men's magazine from scratch, how to start a beauty empire, as we speak to one of the country's biggest names in skincare and beauty and all these sort of things. That's Liz Earle. Yeah, episode after that, then it'll be the July Edinburgh extravaganza. We'll be chatting to the granddaddy of Edinburgh, Peter Buckley Hill. So thank you to all our guests from this week. If you like who you hear, do seek them out online. They're all on the social medias and things. And indeed, if you like this podcast, you could donate, you could be a patron, all of that sort of thing on heptagonclub.co.uk. You could just share us, tell your friends on Twitter and Facebook and things like that. Do also check out Home for Good, Chris's fostering and adoption charity we heard about earlier. If you're even remotely intrigued by that as a possibility, it's well worth looking at his website online. Lots more information there. His website online. What am I saying? I'm saying some weird things this time. I'm really sorry. Of course his website is online. It's a website. Therefore it's online. If it were offline, it would be a piece of paper. No. Home for Good. Have a Google. It is there online. If you like podcasts generally...
Like everyone else in the world, I'm doing a podcast, which means the podcast listenership now is down to predominantly how many people are on the podcast. So well done for booking seven.
That's the idea, yeah.
But yeah, I'm still doing my book shambles with Josie Long, and I'm about to put out a series of podcasts with Alan Moore as well, my mate Grace Petrie, who is a fantastic folk singer, and I would highly recommend, if you don't know Grace Petrie's work, go to her website. So I will recommend Grace Petrie, and I'll recommend Josie Long's tour, if that continues anywhere in the UK. We've been out in Australia, work together, and she remains a wonderful, exuberant human being.
Brilliant. We'll listen to those, all of us, and please go for Robin Innes.
Thank you.
So, the concluding headlines for this week. We conclude with the headlines? No, headlines at the start. This is going all over the place this time around. I'm so sorry. Mailing list, please do join up. It's in the episode info or at paulcarenza.com, about three paragraphs down. Join my mailing list. Do come and see my new live show, Navelless Gazing. It is on between now and September at places like Kettering, Liverpool, Camden, Guildford, that sort of stuff. Hey, you, has anybody said to you today? Live good lives, be nice to each other. Thank you to Rob Halligan for the music. Thank you to you for listening. You look positively beautiful in. Do share us, rate us, help us get into other people's ears. That would be amazing. And we will see you in about a month for seven more brilliant guests at the Heptagon Club. So long for now.